Accession number 9338, reel 14.
Doug Turner, tape 14. Did you ever come up against the law, Doug, while you were a conscientious objector? In Britain, this would be.
Whether I came up against the law or not, I don't know. I certainly met with the law on a few occasions, mostly, fortunately, of an amusing character. Possibly this was because I was wearing a beard, and beards in wartime, as one knows, usually indicates that you must therefore be a German fifth columnist. One of these indeed occurred during the week when Germany had invaded Holland, and rather foolishly we found ourselves hitchhiking in the East Coast area, and quite rightly the police were concerned. And we were happily walking along with huge rucksacks on our back when a car drew up and a plainclothes policeman climbed out and introduced himself and wanted to know who we were. We gave him straightforward answers, and he then looked at our rucksacks and made the comment that they seemed rather bulky, and I said, yes, well, they must be, mustn't they? They're full of bombs and submachine guns. My companion rolled over on his back laughing, and the policeman looked at me, a little ironically at first, and then said, all right. He said, okay. He said, I know where you're going. He said, you're going up to the Langham, Langham community, aren't you? And if you take this road here and then you take the left up there, you'll find it. That passed off reasonably well. On another occasion, we were hitchhiking across the country, and it was evening time, and we found that we could go no further on the journey, and we got landed up somewhere in Bedfordshire on a bus, and when one of the passengers wanted to know who we were, and I very politely told him to mind his own business, and he then insisted that we hand over our identity cards to him, and I again replied that we had no legal requirement to hand over the cards whatsoever, and suggested that he mind his own business again, and he became very, very abusive. And when we ultimately drew it in the bus station, in no time, the policeman was on top of us, demanding to interview us. And we allowed ourselves quite rightly to be interviewed accordingly. We unloaded our rucksacks at his request, and he went through them, even squeezing the toothpaste out of the tube. And then he began to flip through a copy of the New Testament which my comrade had with him, and I again suggested that he should stop doing that. And he looked at me and said, well, why should I stop doing that? And I said, well, it's seditious literature, and we shall be in trouble if you read that. And he grunted, and then became much more friendly and inclined. But this didn't apparently satisfy our passenger friend, who shouted out that if he'd have had his way, he would have assaulted us in order to obtain our identity cards, whereupon the policeman turned round to him and said, you just shut up. These lads are completely in the right, and they behaved quite legally in refusing to let you have a look at their identity cards. They were obeying the law. You don't appear to be. Victory to us. On another occasion, I was stopped, presumably again because I had a beard, by a man in shirt sleeves who introduced himself and said, I'd like to see your identity card. And I said, oh, yes. And he said, well, and I said, yes. And he said, well, he said, I want to see your identity card. He said, I'm a special constable. He said, I have a right to ask to see your identity card. And I said, well, You certainly have a right to see my identity card if you are what you claim to be, but how do I know you're a special constable? And he said, I said, have you got any warrant card on you? And he said, no, I haven't. As a matter of fact, I've left it at home. I said, you know very well, you should know as a special constable, that I have no legal requirement to hand over my identity card to you. You're a perfect stranger to me. Before I hand over my identity card, I want to see your warrant card. And he was very flummoxed by this, and he then said, are you going to walk along with me to my house? He says, no, I'll go in and get it. I said, I'm going in your direction. I said, so no trouble to me. So I walked along with him, and he was becoming more and more agitated by this time. And when we got to his gate, he said, are you going to remain by the gate while I go and get my identity card, my warrant card? I says, look, I said, I'll even walk up to your front door with you. And by this time he was completely bewildered, and he came to the door. He says, there's my identity card, there's my warrant card. And I said, in that case, I said, yes, I said, I will show you my identity card. By this time he didn't even want to look at it. The other case was a rather sad case. I hadn't been living at White Way long when I arrived home from work quite happily and cheerfully, and to be met by one of the other inhabitants who, with whom we shared the dwelling, an elderly actor, Irish actor, who was extremely worried and agitated, coming to meet me and saying, oh dear, he said, before you go in the house, Douglas, he said, I must warn you, he said, the police have raided the place and they wanted to know who you were, and they've taken away all your papers and all your letters and everything. And I said, I entered, and lo and behold, I discovered that they had taken all my correspondence and all my papers, magazines, journals, everything. And I then learned that they were still on the colony, visiting another pacifist's home. And I promptly went up there, and there were police cars outside, and inside there were five hefty policemen, one a detective superintendent, one a detective sergeant, and couple of local constables, all in plain clothes, and there they were questioning some of my other comrades, shouting, one of them, the detective sergeant, particularly shouting and bawling away at the top of his voice, and I was certainly very, very angry. And as I entered the cottage, the policeman on duty at the door tried to stop me. But he failed in this, because I just pushed his arm down and walked in, and then introduced myself and said, my name's Turner. I believe you want to see me also. This stopped them in mid-air, and then they said, oh, yes, we want to see you. I said, I'm here now, in sort of a cockney attitude, I suppose I had. And we then, rather hammer and tongs battle developed. They were accusing the objectors of being cowards, of being frightened, of not wishing to support the war effort, of being communists, of being anarchists, of being fascists, all in turn. And I then pointed out the contradictions as they were implying, which seemed to stop them for a moment, and then they wanted to know what I was doing before the war, and I explained that I'd been very active in the labour movement, and what was I being active in? And I said, I was protesting about the living conditions of poor people, of the poverty which existed, of people sometimes dying from starvation. And one of them whipped round and he said, that's a lie. Nobody Starves in England, to which I had already retort and said, well, no, they didn't die of starvation, they died of malnutrition. This promptly stopped him, and he stared at me, opened his mouth, and stopped. By this time I realised I was in charge of the conversation. Anyway, I suggested that they hand back my property to me, and they refused to do. I said, well, I was not even... you were not even aware that I was living on the place when I you came, and therefore I cannot be in any be under any suspicion whatsoever. You must have some evidence. The evidence apparently amounting to a rather casual letter written by a very young resident. He was only 17 at the time, a young objector, who had written to Nellie Shaw inquiring about anarchism, which was a purely philosophical aspect anyway. And he apparently had lost this letter, and the suggestion was that someone had picked it up, opened it, and then handed it to the police. It seems a rather feeble excuse, but we never really did find out the reason for the raid in the first place, because Whiteway was well known by everyone in the area, having been there for some 50 years. Anyway, the upshot of this was that we were very concerned about the police behaviour, particularly as the detective sergeant had said to one of the young men, you know what I'd like to do with you? I'd like to give you a slug under the jaw. Following this, I decided to make a direct approach to the chief constable, and I went down to the county constabulary where I was allowed to see the deputy chief constable, who took the action, that took the approach that they were perfectly in their rights. And if I wanted to make any protest, then I should do it in the proper manner. I should write. And that was the end of the conversation. As I went out, it was clear that the local policeman in the outlying office had been made aware of who I was. And even as I went out of the door, one of them tried to jam me in between the door as I departed. This showed the general attitude. Anyway, we got together again and we decided that to write to the National Council for Civil Liberties in the first instance. We did this, outlining the story, and they very kindly wrote back to us and gave us their advice and the lines on which we should write a letter to the Chief Constable. This I duly did, expressing myself very courteously and suggesting in my letter that the attitude of the particular detective sergeant was surely did not reflect the attitude of the average British constable. A few days later, I was working in the fields, and lo and behold, a police car drew up, and the detective superintendent and one of the local bobbies walked across the fields to meet me, and very politely said, well, Mr. Turner, we have arrived in response to your letter to the Chief Constable, and let me say at the very beginning that you are not going to get a written reply. So I said, well, this seemed rather at variance with their insistence that I should make the approach by letter, and this embarrassed him. But he said, well, that's the situation, you're not going to get a written reply. And you also had advice in the writing of your letter, haven't you? And I said, well, so what if I had? He said, well, he says, you admit you have. He says, you had it from the NCLC, haven't you? I said, so what? All right, we've had it from the NCLC, so what? He said, well, let's get down to the questions you've raised. He said, this question of Mr. Owner making this reported remark. He said, you know, he said, I don't necessarily agree that that remark was made? And here the local bobby standing by loyally said, "No, sir, I don't remember it either." So I said, "You don't necessarily recall it being made." He says, "No." He said, "Another thing." He said, "You weren't there when it was made, were you?" He said, "You hadn't even arrived." He said, "And what's more," he said, "when it, he said, "you've got no witnesses." He said, "There were five of us, don't forget." He said, "How many witnesses can you produce?" He said, "In fact," he said, "when it was made, only Lally, the man to whom it was made, was present in the room." He says, "You had no witnesses." He says, "Our word against yours." I said, I then said, "Well, but in superintendent, there was a witness." And he said, "There wasn't." I said, "But there was." I said, "Robert was in the next room." And he overheard this remark. He said, "Robert was in the garden when it was made." I said, "He was in the next room." He said, "He was in the garden." And I said, "But superintendent, is that what you're going to say if there's an investigation that Robert was in the garden when the remark was made?" This completely flummoxed him, and he lost his temper, swore at me, and then calmed down again and said, "Well, look," he said, "we can bring a case against Robert." He said, "He never had an identity card. He never had a ration book." I said, "Well, that is quite correct." I said, "Now," he said, "if you forget this," he said, "we won't bring a case." I said, "Superintendent, you go ahead and bring your case against Robert. We'll bring ours." By this time, he was really on tenterhooks, and I realised again I was in command of the dialogue. Anyway, it was clear he was a very worried man, and I did feel that he was in an invidious situation, because although he was in charge of the raid, I think he was also extremely embarrassed by the behaviour of his detective sergeant. And when I challenged him on this, he agreed that this was so. He had been embarrassed. And he said, "Look," he said, "I do agree." He said, "He should not have made that remark." He said, "And," he said, "you must be aware that we do have to investigate." He said, there is always a possibility of spies being about. And he said, "I'm fully aware," he said, "that many cases I have to investigate, the people are completely innocent." And I said, "But superintendent," and here I am, my own class consciousness came inevitably to the fore. I couldn't help remarking to him that if he was looking for fascists, then I suggested that he should look in other directions rather than the British working class. He again took this very well and admitted this was so. With that, they departed. We later again discussed the issue. We felt by this time that we had made our point sufficiently well, that we didn't want to be venomous in our continuing with the case. We'd made our point, they had responded, and I then wrote a further letter to the constabulary suggesting that if they cared to come and meet us with a more open mind, we would forget the issue. 2 days later, they turned up one evening, knocking very gently on the door, very politely reintroducing themselves, and obviously had come determined to repair the previous damage, even the detective sergeant being on his best behaviour, commenting very politely on the books on the bookshelf. And with that, we separated. It was not at all infrequent after that to meet the local bobbies and the other officers, and there was always a salute for me. I could have got away, I think, almost with murder. I think what, looking back on it, what really angered me in the first instance was not the any illegality in the raid itself, nor the taking away of my magazines and other items. It was the fact that some of my correspondence included letters from the woman I was very much in love with, and the fact that to think of them just poring over these very personal letters, and it's probably made me far more angry than any of the political implications which followed.
Did you know of anything being spoken in the House of Commons, or did you read anything in the press?
Well,
Brian
Sorensen, of course, was still living on the colony at that time, and we met his father, Reg, on one of his visits, and we gave him the full details, and he said, well, if there are any difficulties here, I'll certainly raise the matter in the House of Commons on your behalf. And the police had become aware of this as well, and of course this no doubt played a very real part in their future behaviour. Rather interestingly enough, our elderly actor friend left the colony in order to take a job on selling encyclopedias, and he had the nerve to visit our friend the detective sergeant in his own police station and sold him a complete set of encyclopedias.
You were saying earlier, when you were talking about your good relations with the troops, that really you related much better to servicemen than you did civilians. Did you generally experience much hostility from ordinary civilians, you know, during the war in England?
A certain amount, mainly to strangers. Of course, on one occasion I'd been picked up, I was hitchhiking one night and been picked up by some local people, and it came out almost inevitably that I was a conscientious objector. They wanted to know all about me and what I was doing, and there was a certain amount of abuse from them, and I got to the point where I said, well, if you feel like that, I'll get out and walk. Although I was extremely tired, I'd been walking all day, but they rebuffed this and became a little more friendly, and then suggested that if I wanted to, didn't want to go in the fighting forces, why didn't I be like them and work in a munitions factory where I could earn very good money? They seem to be completely oblivious to the real reason for being an objector at all. A rather sad reflection, perhaps, on the general intelligence of so many people.
This term, conchy, now, who used it? Did people call you conches, or did you call yourselves conches?
I don't like the word conchy at all. We were known as conches, of course, and always with those people whom you worked with, you might get a certain amount of derogatory comments about conscientious objectors, but of course we don't mean you. You're different. This was so constant, of course, that of course had they met the others, they would have been different too, but it's rather a similar situation as to about people who know black people who are of course different from other blacks whom they don't know. This is one of our most beloved of prejudices, as to all prejudices, of course. You're a stranger until you're accepted. I'm reminded rather of an old, very old joke in a Victorian Punch of two men standing talking and one saying to the other, "Oi, Charlie, who's that bloke over there?" "Oh, don't know, he's a stranger to me, mate." "Well, throw a brick at him then." And this seems to sum up so much of our own prejudices somehow. I think it was Montaigne said somewhere, every man calls barbarism that to which he is not accustomed.
Well, Doug Turner, thank you very much indeed for sharing so many of your experiences and thoughts with us. Thank you.
Thank you.